It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists. With your host, Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
Hello, I'm Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And we are doing that today via Zoom. And we are going to be talking about the art and science of nature's flavors, and specifically about spices and wine. So Mark, we have some really interesting guests joining us today. So why don't you introduce them to our listeners and get our conversation started?
Great. Well, we've got Claire Cheney, who's the founder and blender in chief, which I love, by the way, of Curio Spice Company. And you're out in the Boston area. Aren't you specifically in Newton? Is that right?
In Cambridge.
Cambridge. That's what it, okay. And so it's really great. Claire and Susan run a series of shows that you learn to pivot. You used to do them in your actual shop, but you've not been able to. So I met them through one of those. We welcome you, Claire. And then we've also got Susan, who's the events manager and the graphics designer for the company. Hi, Susan.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
And Jill Bloom. Is it enology?
It is enology.
And we'll talk a little bit about what that is, but you're a specialist with the Purdue Wine Grape Team at Purdue University in West Lafayette.
Welcome, Jill.
Thank you, Jill.
And we have Jill Patel, who we've had on a show before, who's a PhD neuroscientist candidate at Indiana University School of Medicine, and also has an incredible kind of history with as a cook. So we're going to get into cooking and spice and wine and drinking and all that.
Thanks for joining us again, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
So we have Jill.
I know.
It's Susan and Claire and Mark.
So I thought I really wanted to start out with the idea of spices and flavors and thinking about how those actually work for us. And so Claire and Susan, if you wanted to jump in, a lot of what you did was to found a spice company. Talk to me about that.
Well, I am very curious about where flavor comes from. I've always loved cooking since I grew up. And actually my first love affair with spices was with the spice saffron. And I started doing research about where saffron came from, and I went into a deep dive into Greek history and ancient frescoes from Crete, and was very interested in the relationship between medicine and food from ancient times, and how that kind of has played into modern day spice fascination, and particularly now everyone knows about the turmeric craze that's been going on for several years in America. Another golden spice. So that's my inspiration of how I got into spices. And then I basically expanded that into researching other spices and origins and founded the company so that I could just spend my life doing that.
That's really wonderful. Kind of take your passion, both your art and your humanities of history in that, and go into that. And Susan, how did you come to get connected to Claire?
We met while working for a friend's farm. Both of us were at very different points in our lives. I'm old enough to be Claire's mom. but we were both doing that, me for fun and Claire as part of her, you know, multiplicity of gigs that you do when you're younger and
my 12 jobs.
Yeah. And we hit it off just immediately. So this is a a market farm just outside of Boston. It's a fairly large market farm. They grow about 70 acres of organic produce. So, you know, through a love of literature, through a love of cooking, through a love of talking, whatever, we really hit it off. And I don't know, one thing led to another. And then by the time that Claire started Curio for real and we had a space, I was sort of taking a little sabbatical. So just said, oh, I'll come help out. You know, just you need the walls painted, you need the whatever. And then one thing and another, and here we are.
That's cool. Really
wonderful story.
Yeah. And Jill Bloom, I've known you for quite a long time because I've had the pleasure of working with the food science department at Purdue and the Indiana wine grape team. But what, tell people about, I mean, a lot of people don't know that Indiana has a lot of wine.
It does. We have over 1 million gallons produced here in Indiana. Which is, and one of our wineries is probably, I always say it's the largest winery east of the Rockies. So we're, you know, probably within the top 10 producing gallonage in the nation. I don't think a lot of people realize that, but Indiana does produce a lot of wine. We have about 100 wineries now scattered all across Indiana. You know, mom and pop, small ones, and really large ones too. So,
Joe, do a lot of people grow grapes there? I mean, you think of corn and soybeans.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. We don't have a lot of grapes. We do have about 600 acres of grapes, and we're still looking for. Purdue works a lot with. University of Minnesota and Cornell on new cold hardy varieties that they're developing. So we have a experimental vineyard that we plant those newly released grapes and then we make wine with them and show them to our wineries and our winemakers in Indiana and try to, you know, orient them with the new varieties that are emerging. So it's still a really new industry in the Midwest. I've been doing it now for almost 25 years. I know, Jill, you have too, so.
I know.
And the varieties just keep coming. So it's only getting better every year. We're still young.
I would think the soil there, because it's so much limestone, I would think that would be very grape friendly if you could get the.
That's right. We deal pretty much with extreme cold temperatures. You know, 15 below for a few minutes can be very detrimental to grape varieties. So,
yeah.
So obviously Indiana has to bring in some grapes in addition to growing their own. Claire and Susan, where do you source your spices?
We source from all over the world. We source directly from about 15 countries. So that those are places that I've traveled and met the producers to form a relationship. We often get multiple spices from one origin, like we get 6 or 7 spices from our partners in Sri Lanka. But we also, I'm proud to say, we also source from a lot of domestic producers. And this year we're going to launch a box called Homegrown, which is all featuring U.S. grown spices. And we, it won't be in the box this year, but we have, for example, gotten saffron from a farmer in Illinois, which is out near you all. So that's
wow. And that's a tedious process, obviously, of doing that.
University of Vermont is also doing some real interesting work around saffron. So something that's, you know, unusual. Another cool thing here in Massachusetts, speaking of like climates and how you make things work, we have a farm that we adore that's out in Amherst, and they grow, they've got a grant. They were interested in figuring out how you could grow ginger and turmeric in Massachusetts. And part of the grant was that they had to write that up and share it with other farmers, which they've done. And so now there are several farmers who are doing this in the region. but they grow absolutely gorgeous ginger and turmeric. So we get some of the products that they make from that. And sometimes if they have enough, we actually get their dried spice products as well. And they're really beautiful, and they definitely have a terroir. The ginger is different than the ginger from Sri Lanka or Costa Rica.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Jill, I wanted to kind of bring you in with the idea first. Your research has been on fear and things that scare people. When we're in the middle of a really big pandemic, and food, wine, taste, people are really into making their own stuff. Is there something about that as to why we go to food and wine when we are stressed?
Really good question. I think, so my research is, you know, focused on fear, which is very evolutionarily important. And so is food and drink. And even when you're talking about spices, like a lot of your responses to spices are kind of based in evolution. Like anything sweet that would give you energy is something you would want. And so it's desired versus, you know, bitter is more closer to poison. And so people usually shy away from that. And so in terms of this idea of like people wanting to make things, I think that's also very evolutionary, because if you're stuck at home, and I know I've had that when I was quarantined, I don't have much else to do, especially if it's cold outside or you can't really do much else with your family. I mean, your kitchen is the place you can go to and start creating something, and it's useful. So I think a lot of it has to do with people just wanting to find comfort. And I guess it was, you know, a time of fear. So if you can find comfort in your food and your wine and your spices that are going to make you feel a lot better, then I think that was probably more psychological. I don't know if there were like physiological reasons and maybe if things that people created actually helped them, but I would definitely say it was more like psychologically important for people to hunker down and start baking a lot of bread.
That's great.
Jill, you brought up some terms and some things that people tend to feel more comfortable with sweetness as opposed to bitterness. And Susan, you brought up the term terroir. And sweetness and bitterness and terroir are all very important elements of wine, Jill Bloom. And as we talk about terroir, and as Susan and Claire were talking about, you know, growing spices and the flavors that they have, there are certain grapes that give off like these flavors and tastes, Jill, but they're not really like in the grape. I think sometimes that confuses people about the importance of terroir and what types of soil and climate can coax out those flavors and those reactions in wine grapes for people. Can you kind of speak to that a little bit, Jill, about the kind of the science of a wine grape, like it's the quality of it, why we might drink a wine and we might smell ginger in it, but there's no ginger in it. And it might taste bitter, but it's not made to be bitter. We still are, it's still appealing to us.
Sorry, I thought that was for the other, for Jahil's, but anywho, I guess my answer to that would be a lot of it is there's the smell of grapes and the grape wine, and then there's something called like the bouquet. And a lot of times you get the bouquet from how you alter the wine while you're making the wine. So, you know, a lot of times we say, oh, the wine might may smell like strawberries. We're not adding strawberries per se, but maybe it's because, like Jill said, there's something in the soil that makes this grape variety taste more like strawberries. Another thing that winemakers do is a lot of times they barrel wines, or they put the wines in oak barrels, and oak barrels can give all kinds of flavors, from vanilla to butterscotch to caramel, to charred barbecue. So a lot of it is the winemaking style and what the winemakers, how they treat the wine after they're fermented.
So one of the common things here between spices and the wine is that they emit these what we would call VOCs, which people are familiar with not wanting in their paint, but are volatile organic compounds. And those affect us in different ways. And I think that that's really interesting because sometimes it's for, I would assume, Claire, the plant is emitting it for a reason, even in its seed, to either attract something to eat it or to repel something from eating it. And I think in the grape, we pick up things from where it is. And I think that's really interesting because, like you were saying, Susan, saffron grown in parts of Boston might be totally different than another place, just as wine's grown in different soils.
Yeah, and like Jill said, that, you know, the grapes from one place or another, they have a common flavor profile, but it changes both with growing and then how it's handled and how it's processed. So an example of that that we were just talking about in the last couple of weeks, Claire has set us some sensory training exercises each week. And a couple of weeks ago we did ginger. And one of the things that happens with ginger is that the pungency of the ginger changes just through the dehydration. So there's a chemical just with air drying. There's a change in those flavors from fresh ginger to the dried ginger. And so it, you know, it affects lots of spices that way.
Claire, you want to say something?
Yeah, that's some spices and wine are like that in a lot of ways because they're so different. You really do have to sample the ones that you prefer. So Susan, some people might really not like fresh ginger, but ground ginger is really appealing to them.
I was going to say in the wine industry, a lot of times wines can be oxidized with either age or just being exposed to oxygen, and it totally changes the flavors. And that's really a quality issue that in the wine industry, that's very detrimental to wines. And that has so much impact, just that impact of oxygen in wines and how much it changes the flavor and the freshness and how we perceive it in our mouth. So I know for wine, oxygen is to me, it's like the evil of wine.
Yeah, I guess I have a question for Jill, because one of the things I'm really interested in is the vocabulary around naming tastes and smells. And it's very challenging, even for me and someone who does this all the time, to sometimes identify all the, you know, minute differences in a food or in a wine. And I'm curious how much research has been done in brain science and neuroscience about memory and our kind of instinctual, you were talking about survival earlier and like the evolutionary impact of taste. And I'm just curious about how memory plays into our sense of smell and taste.
That is a really, really great question. And I don't study it, but I remember when I was being taught about smell, that was one of the things that I think it's newly emerging, but I think it's also something like that you, just from like stories of what people tell, you know, this is real because your taste buds are connected to your brain, obviously. So your taste receptors are, you know, sending signals to your brain, and that's how you can even perceive, like, this is what this tastes like, this is sweet, this is sour, whatever. But also your taste and your sense of taste and your sense of smell are so interconnected, and the brain regions that they send the signals to are also so interconnected with like memory storage. And so you have like instances where people smell something and they immediately like go back in time to like a childhood memory. And that's actually like your sense of smell, I think, is more stronger in that sense. And I know that taste and smell are so linked together that the taste also like that definitely has something to do with memory. And you very like strong memories, I think you tend to store those kinds of sensory information more. And mm-hmm. that's when, and so you have this intricate links of your taste, smell, and whatever, you know, is going on around you. That there is definitely, there's research. I don't know enough about it, but I know that there, this is like a newly emerging area of research. And also it's not as like clinically relevant. So it's not studied as expansively, but I think it's really interesting.
Well, I think that, you know, evolutionarily that makes sense, what you're talking about. That we, as humans, I know we always compare ourselves to dogs who have an incredible sense of smell. But as humans, we really have an amazing sense of smell as opposed to some other species as well, and our taste. So I think those two in combination protected us, you know, over evolution from eating something that would make us sick or kill us. So well, Claire, how did we get to where, so this is the thing, how did we get to where we find these spices that, you know, come from berries and they come from plants and they come from other things? How do we ever discover these? Maybe you don't know the answer, but I think it's curious to me.
I don't know entirely, but I just wanted to throw in there before I forgot that it's fascinating that one of the at-home tests for COVID is your sense of smell.
I was thinking the same thing. Yep.
So just a fascinating side note, but and that's scary. You know, I don't want to lose my sense of smell. Certainly no. From COVID or anything else, but it comes back, I've heard. So there's that. I think about that a lot. What was our original human attraction to spices? Because they're not clearly essential to our survival, as in they don't provide us with protein or essential nutrients. I mean, certainly there are health benefits that are important to having spices in your diet, but you could live without them. And so I think it's a fascinating combination of science and art, in the sense of, you know, spices are there. We're attracted to them because they give us pleasure and they create happy memories. And certainly the whole holiday season, which has a lot of fragrant marketability. You think of the fir scented candles, the cinnamon brooms that you get.
Pumpkin spice.
It's unbelievable, but it's because there's so much nostalgia, or, you know, positive nostalgia. Or can nostalgia be negative? I don't know. Maybe it's all
pumpkin spice can be. For some people.
It can be gross.
That's good. And that's exactly what we're talking about, is adding a little zest to life today with spices and things from nature. And we're doing so with Claire Chaney, with Susan Turner, with Jill Patel, and Jill Bloom. And we're going to take a short break, and then we will be right back with more of our conversation. Stay tuned.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're talking about nature's flavors when it comes to spices and wine and the brain. And we're with Claire and Susan from Curio Spice Company in Boston, Jill from the Purdue Wine Grape Team, and Jill Patel from the IU School of Medicine. And, you know, we were briefly talking a little about, right before the break, the idea of COVID and losing your sense of taste and smell, which seemed to be abhorrent to both Claire and Jill Bloom, to imagine that you would do that. And it's interesting to me, because a little bit of the research that I've read on that is that I'm not sure why, and maybe we'll find out, but somehow that virus hijacks those, and others turns them off, which is very strange. And I don't know if it's a mechanism to help it reproduce or to do something, but it brings me to the point that what an awful thing to imagine losing those two, not just one, but both of those. And then Jill, you were talking, Bloom, you talked to me a little bit about the idea that we have to retrain the brain, which I think is an interesting problem.
Yeah, I just read an article today that some people that have COVID lose their sense of smell and taste, and they're thinking it's affecting the neurons. Mm-hmm. And again, you lose that connection. And so you gradually have to retrain your olfactory, which is your nose and your mouth working together. You kind of have to retrain that whole system after you have the virus. So, but I don't think everyone experiences it. But
yeah, that's what's been interesting. Some people say they do, and some people say they don't. And Jill, would you have any reason to know why that is with your knowledge of the brain and how things work? And
I don't think I have a good answer for that, except to just say that the symptoms have been so diverse, generally speaking, even with like asymptomatic patients, because there's such a big percentage of them. And so for me, it's been interesting to read like about all the symptoms. And so I don't think I have a clear answer for why it affects people the way it does, honestly. And no idea about the sense of smell either.
No, and you wouldn't be alone in that, Jill. Actually, scientists and doctors know very little about this virus. That's why it's so confusing. But to lose that smell, one of the things it's curious to me is that I've been reading a little bit about that spices, there's certain ones you can put together, and there's certain ones that don't go together. And there's some science behind why. I guess that some of the science is flavor groups and some of the science is in there. And I'm curious about your experiences, all of you. Jill, same way. I know you originally were born in India, and there's the thing called the spice box, which people have at home. It's a family thing where you have your own spices. But there are certain things that go in there and work, and there's things that don't. So any of you can jump in on that. But I know spices have this really unique weirdness as to how they work or don't work.
Claire, why don't you start with us, and then we'll move through.
Well, the way I approach combining spices, since I do a lot of spice blending, is to think about how they layer. So, and this is something I learned. I studied with a natural perfumer named Mandy Eftel. She's out in California, and she's a brilliant perfumer, used to be a therapist, so she has this very sort of psychological approach to understanding scent. And sort of similar to perfume and also to music and thinking about making a chord. So you think about having a low bass note, a middle note, and a high note, and those three together create a harmony and work really well together. So in some ways, you want to have a spice from each of those categories in order to make a harmonious combination. There are so many spices in the world that it's a little bit hard to say, you know, how many different combinations there might be, basically endless. But I would say there are absolutely ones that don't get along very well.
Can you give us an example of a couple that do, and maybe one that doesn't, that people can actually find and try at home?
For sure. One of my favorite spices to blend with is cumin. I think it's one of those crowd pleasers. It's I think of it as a base note. So you can start with cumin and layer in something in the middle, like cinnamon, that is has a little bit of sweetness to balance with the earthiness of cumin. And then you want something on the top that would kind of brighten it up and be kind of festive. And I think coriander is a really good example. That's another very common spice in the spice pantry. And coriander is very citrusy and lemony. And those three together work really well. That isn't like a classic spice mix. I just use that as examples, but you would find those in probably a lot of different spice mixes if it were a curry blend or something like that. But
and what might not work together?
Well, there are certain flavors that are very pungent, very strong. One of one of the spices that when our shop was open to the public, people would often come in and ask about is juniper, a very piney spice. I love the flavor, but it's very difficult to pair with other spices because basically you put juniper with anything else and it tastes like juniper. It's so strong. But you can pair it with black pepper, for example. But, you know, I haven't tried juniper and mushrooms, for example. Actually, that might be really nice.
I think it would be. You know, you think of juniper, you think of gin. So you think a lot of gin has that notes to it, and that's that earthy funkiness to it. And Jill Bloom, that's a lot of way how you pair a lot of wine and food, isn't it? Kind of that same system.
It is a lot of the same system. And you were talking about juniper, which is very overpowering. In the wine world, Concord is very overpowering. So if you think about Welch's grape juice, that's from Concord grape. A lot of times people like to blend different grape varieties together. That's a grape variety that it only takes small amounts of Concord and you can taste it fully in the wine. So you have to be really careful if you would add Concord. Usually folks don't add Concord. You just have Concord as the base wine, but it's, you know, and the other thing is with wines is being, it's a natural product. You know, you kind of know what you're going to get, but after winemaking, a lot of times you don't know what you're going to get. You don't know what the aromas are going to be. So it is a little bit of a guessing game.
But you do know that certain grapes, like you said, with Concord, it can be kind of overpowering. And there are certain grapes that kind of do elicit certain smells and such that maybe will go better with foods or with some of the spices that Claire was talking about.
So both Claire and Jill, doesn't that create a little bit of difficulty when you try to encourage people to branch out? Because aren't they afraid on both picking a wine and picking a spice combination? Aren't they a little afraid of experimenting and going, yuck, you know, after they put it in their food? Because yeah, I would assume, Claire, it's also different having it, and Jill the same way, having it without food. In other words, if you taste the spice blend by itself or you taste the wine, that's a different experience than having it with a food pairing. And so how do people begin to branch out?
Well, with spices, I actually really like Susan's story of when she came to start working at Curio. You should just tell the story, Susan, about what you thought about spice blends versus pure spices.
Oh, I thought blend schmend.
Why is that?
So many blends are so flat-footed. They seem almost as if it's just equal parts of, if it's an Italian seasoning, it's equal parts of dried basil and kind of bad garlic powder and I felt like I had individual spices in my cupboard. So it was a revelation to me to have things that were layered and nuanced, the way you could build flavor within a dish when you're cooking by adding things at different times or tasting and saying, oh, I think this would be good or something like that. So that was a revelation that blends didn't have to be that way, and what a pleasure it is to have them on hand for, especially for adding a quick shot of flavor to something. One thing that I've done that about flavors that you would think would go together but don't. So I make at the holidays, a Russian friend taught me to make this cranberry liqueur that's really nice. It's just a vodka-based liqueur and cranberries and sugar syrup. And I thought how pretty it would be to have, you know, a lot of times in holiday drinks, they'll do a cranberry spirit on a rosemary, you know, frozen cranberry spirit on a rosemary stem or something like that. And I thought, rosemary, oh my gosh, that would be amazing. So I made, instead of plain simple syrup, I made rosemary simple syrup. And luckily I had the presence of mind to make a sample drop or two to taste before just pouring all that simple syrup in, because shockingly, it tasted exactly like Robitussin.
I was just thinking of the astringency of it when you've got cranberries and you've got rosemary.
I mean, that's sugar. There's a lot of sugar.
Of your
that's how they make that cough syrup.
Probably.
So I saved the rosemary simple syrup to put on oranges and things like that. I'm fine.
See, you're talking about education, and that's what you do to help educate people. And Jill Bloom, that's a lot what you do too, is to help guide people so they're not afraid to try different things.
Yeah, I was going to say, we encourage folks to do blends a lot, because with our blends in wine, you might get one grape variety might give you more aroma. Another grape variety might give you more tannins, kind of that grit you get on your tongue. So all grape varieties offer something different. So blends to me are just really important in the wine industry. And when you go to the grocery shelf and look for wines, a lot of times the wines are just by name and not by grape variety. And those are most likely blends. And also, wines can be named a grape variety, but it may only be 75% of the grape variety in the wine. So we use a lot of blends in winemaking.
It's a good tool. Some good tips there as we are talking about the art and science of nature's flavors today. And we want to remind you that this program is made possible by the generosity of an anonymous donor who supports the Da Vinci Pursuit's mission of creating a museum without walls so that we can have artists, scientists, and the community come together for unique activities and conversations, including this one. We're going to take another short break, and then we will be back with more. Stay tuned.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
And welcome back. We are talking about nature's flavors when it comes to spices and wines, specifically flavors and tastes that go together and those that don't. And a lot of that obviously has to do with what we smell and what we taste. And Jill Bloom, there's a science, once again, behind winemaking, but also wine tasting and where certain receptors are on our tongue.
Well, that's actually been ruled out, those zones on your tongue. They used to say that you tasted sweet on the front, in the middle. That's no longer true. I think some people have, someone else can answer this, but some people have more receptors than other folks, so they would be more like super, super receptor people. But all the receptors are everywhere on your tongue for sweet and sour and salty. And
Jill, that's really interesting, because my wife, I think, is a super taster. Mm-hmm. And she picks up flavors and spice in wine and food that can take her to the extreme that I don't even do, like something that's bitter. And so something will be more bitter to her than it is to me. And she's the same way with certain wines. If I can switch wine, drinking red wine, I can have a different wine. I run out of one, I can go to a different wine. She can't, because it's just is really unappealing. The taste is different. So that's interesting, Jill. I mean, really interesting.
Yeah. And once again, is she a good smeller? I mean, she smells good, Mark. I know that. But I mean, is her sense of smell pretty strong too? Because that is so
linked. Yes, both of them. And Jill and I know a person here in the IU School of Medicine, Bill Sullivan, who's really studied that idea of super taste. Mm-hmm. And he uses it for himself as to why he doesn't like broccoli and Brussels sprouts. But there are some people that seem to have more receptors per their tongue than other people. And I think that's interesting in part of that. So Claire, is that something, or Susan, is that something that you guys also get, where some spice, just a little bit of it, makes a huge difference for somebody more than another person?
Well, I think it's linked to how adventurous people are, because I think if you're if you're a super taster or hyper taster, you're so sensitive that that those subtle things really can bother you, as you were describing with your wife with switching wines. So certainly with spices, in terms of trying new things and trying different flavors, I think those that are more sensitive are less likely to take those risks than others. I know I am not a super taster because I try lots of terrible things. And it's just part of my work, but it doesn't bother me too much. But I am interested in how you can build up a tolerance for unusual tastes, and particularly with chili peppers. When I lived in Thailand, the food there when I first arrived was somewhat inedible. It was so hot. And then by the end of it, you know, I'm like, oh, bring on the chilies. And I really craved it. I really craved that like dopamine effect of that rush of feeling you get from eating hot chilies.
Yeah, I wanted to bring you in because I know a little story about you with this. During this time, you were able to rediscover some recipes from your mother, like a recipe book, and it had little notes in the sides. And I'm just curious for you to talk a little bit about that experience of discovering your mom's notes about what flavors and spice and those kinds of things in her writing.
Yeah. So this was, I've known about this book, but I think I kind of actually started looking at it during quarantine because I clearly had a lot of time. And so it was just a small book of recipes that she started writing when I think she was in Africa, and she was living there and she would cook a lot. She was starting to discover, you know, more like traditional African recipes too. And so we're originally from India. And so she also has that background. And what's interesting is the recipes that she wrote about, a lot of them were like, you know, traditionally Indian recipes or African recipes, but then there were also a lot of like fusions, which is what she's, I mean, I'd say like, that's where I've learned just kind of experimenting from, is she uses the traditional, even going back to what you were talking about, the spices and like what goes together well. And then she's kind of ventured out and tried to use certain ingredients or even spices that are not common in Indian recipes, and just mixing them together to see what happens. And it's been interesting. And I think it's important for me to mention that like she's also taught me about like what goes together. You were talking about, you know, spice blends and what traditionally goes together well, like all of the flavor profiles and things like that. I mean, in India, we have spices that are used for like medicinal purposes, even in the food, and you have certain ways to prep them and they always go together. But then you have a lot of like experimentation possibilities. You can kind of mix and match a lot of things. And so it was really nice to be able to know that I'm not just experimenting on my own and giving her horrible recipes. It's almost like a family tradition of trying to experiment together. And also to discover that like a lot of different cuisines tend to have similar types of not just ingredients or spices, but I'd say like they all come from this knowledge of like years and years of figuring out what goes well together, if that makes sense. You know, if you look at like Indian or Middle Eastern or, Chinese or South Asian, whatever food, they have this, you can tell that they worked on the recipes for a while to be able to get this like very traditional flavor that you, once you taste, you can tell like this is Indian food. Right. So, yeah.
Wow. Jill, I think that's a lot like with wine too, isn't it? Like certain regional foods actually complement with regional wines and that kind of thing too.
Yeah, I think you're right. I know when I went to Italy, you know, the wines always taste better when you drink them in Italy. So,
of course,
when in Rome. So, and you pair those with the, like you said, the regional foods, and they just seem to work. It's just like, oh, it's a masterpiece. Then if you bring an Italian wine home and try it with your, you know, cheeseburger on the grill or whatever that may be, pizza. It's just, you know, it doesn't work. So I really think, like you said, that goes back to terroir and the regional foods and just culture in general. I think it's years of experimentation.
And the experimenting is good. And Claire, you mentioned that too, about being adventurous and trying things. I mean, obviously we're talking here about the science of all of these of spices and wine, and all of you guys are experts in your field. But people really do just need to find things that taste good to them. It's okay, especially in this time of pandemic. And I'm guessing that might be another good way to fight our fears too. Don't be afraid of food.
Yeah, I think that, go ahead, Claire.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think people get overwhelmed and scared of their spice cupboard sometimes.
Yes.
I heard a customer once describe it as the Bermuda Triangle. It's just things go in there and they get lost. So I often encourage folks at cooking at home to pull out their favorite spices and put them near where they cook, you know, not on the stove, but maybe in a cupboard right next to the stove. So they're within easy reach, and they're also not buried under dozens of other spices. That might just be three or four spices or blends, but they're right there, and then you'll use them more often.
And Jill, up until pandemic, I mean, wineries have, that's why they have wine tasting rooms too, right?
Yes, they have wine tasting rooms so people can taste the wines. Is that what you're getting at and drinking?
Yeah, how to be adventurous. I mean, we're talk about why people shouldn't be afraid.
Oh, yeah. Like with wines, I think so many people get caught up in buying the same wine because they like it. But, you know, there's thousands and thousands of wines available. So I think you should go out of your comfort zone and try new things. I know a lot of people, especially in Indiana, they start with sweet wines or fruit wines and kind of work their way up to maybe a semi-dry Riesling or you know, a less sweet wine and go more for the drier. And in years, they end up drinking drier wine. So I see that all the time. It doesn't mean you can't like a sweet wine. It's just you could like a sweet wine and a dry wine. So,
yeah. It feels like we've come kind of full circle with this whole conversation in terms that we started thinking about holidays and celebrations and smells and memories. And Jill, you brought us into there with, you know, how wonderful it is to do something with another generation and do it together and experiment and drinking wine, doing spices. I know, Claire, we're coming up to a time when people love to do that kind of thing together, and you guys are always there for them in terms of having, you know, some exciting things. I just ordered myself a Thanksgiving box because it had all kinds of wonderful things in it that I wouldn't have thought to do on my own. And so I think that's a wonderful thing to bring all that together this time of year. What a great thing.
And how important the educational aspect is still when it does come to these things. And I'm guessing for all of you, for your businesses, that's a very important tool.
Yeah, we, from the beginning, partly because I think we just by nature like to share and we want people to be able to experience things. So we've always put an emphasis on the classes, but even more than that, we've quite a catalog and are always working on increasing catalog of recipes that are, we think in general, they're very approachable and often think of them as a bridge or a doorway that's a familiar, there's something familiar about it. So it may be something really simple like popovers, putting saffron in popovers or putting the kozani, which is our Greek inspired and inflected blend that does have a little saffron in it, in there, or a fruit, you know, a simple shortcake that has clove with blackberries, which is one of Claire's amazing combinations that I would never have thought of. So it's just getting that little bit of a taste on your tongue and understanding it. And then also, we love having our teachers of origin, I guess I would say, people who are from a culture, like our friend Suman, who teaches Indian cooking classes, and she often brings in sort of Indian foods in an American kitchen, but introducing people through that to something like asafoetida, which as an American, if you smell that in the jar, you'd think who in their right mind would even put that near the kitchen.
Very funky.
But when it's cooked and when it's in a dish, it is irreplaceable, amazing. And so you have to have somebody kind of guide you, either through a cookbook or a friend or teaching, and we try to make a place where that can happen.
So you're all talking about the core of science right here, which is really, it doesn't have to have a purpose other than you're curious.
That's right.
In other words, you know, tasting a wine, doing a spice, researching something, Jill, I think that's the essence of science when you just go out and you decide, I just am curious about it, I want to know more. And it may not lead to a better dish, or it may not lead to a better wine, or it may not lead to even a great understanding, but it's the pleasure in doing that. And I think that's exciting to blend that art and science together.
And on the art side of it, that to me is like, it's also, it opens you as a person. It opens your, sort of opens your mind, opens your heart. Yeah. When you try something new, the worst that's going to happen is you're not going to finish it. You're going to spit it out. You're going to have a drink of water. You know, it's not going to kill you. You know, it's just like, but taking a chance on it, it opens you in lots of ways to just go a little bit outside your comfort zone.
I think you guys have shared just a lot of great information for our listeners today. And as we kind of wrap this up here, we've got a couple of minutes here, not about a minute left. Where can people find Claire? Where can they find information about your business and your spices?
Oh, we're online at curiospice.com, CURIO spice.com.
And Jill Bloom, if we want wine, what do we do?
Well, you can go to our website, IndianaWines.org, and it will take you a map of all the Indiana wineries.
Plenty of things to do. You can stay distanced and still be social with spice and wine, which is a good thing, isn't it, Mark? Thank you, ladies, all of you, for Jill, Jill, Susan, and Claire. We really thank you for joining us today.
And you're going to find pictures plus the links to each of the locations that our guests were talking about. On our website, thedavincipursuit.com, where we create museums without walls, so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
And until next time, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to
stay curious.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on thedavincipursuit.com. Or you can join your hosts, Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling, here every Saturday at 1 p.m. on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.